time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for June 1st, 2019. It's been a long couple of weeks, and I was under the weather, but I'm back, and I think we have a great show for you this week. The question for tonight is, are we reaching a tipping point for some meaningful change as it pertains to the safety of cyclists and pedestrians on the road? We'll delve into that as we chat with Alex Baca, who works with the advocacy organization Greater Greater Washington in the nation's capital. Alex's background encompasses advocacy on several fronts. We were going to discuss separated bike lanes, why they might be better than painted lanes or sharing the road, but as sometimes happens, a great conversation breaks out on another front, as it did in this one. We'll take a break, and then we'll return for a conversation with Sacramento-based multiple NABs winner, frame builder Steve Rex. Unlike many, if not most, of the frame builders we've spoken with over the years, Steve was, in his own words, a shopkeeper, until just last year when he decided to take his frame building business out of a retail location and build his workshop closer to home. Steve and I talk about his philosophy on fitting, disc brakes, and much more. So before we get started, I just wanted to mention some of the results of the assault on Mount Mitchell, which took place Monday, May 20th, because they're pretty spectacular. Of the almost 800 riders, 600 went the distance on Mount Mitchell of 102.8 miles. The remainder tackled the shorter but nonetheless challenging Mount Marion. Here are some of the results. Mooresville, North Carolina's Seth Jones was the fastest rider this year, completing the assault on Mount Mitchell with a 5 hour, 6 minute, 13-second time. He beat last year's fastest time by 3 minutes. Ina Fuhler from Cincinnati, Ohio, held this year's fastest female time of 7 hours, 1 minute, 50 seconds. Other notable participants, and this is the one that blew me away, was 13-year-old Ben Allen from Charlotte, North Carolina, who finished the assault in 9 hours, 37 minutes, and 37 seconds. Michael Davis from Albemarle, North Carolina, completed the assault on Mount Mitchell for the 39th time in 9 hours, 59 minutes, and 40 seconds. And Justin Tooch joined the event all the way from London with a time of 6:11. 13 years old, huh? Hashtag no excuses for any of us, I guess. So it's time to already start training for the 2020 event. And it's time to move on with the show. Alex Baca has been involved in bicycle and transportation as well as housing advocacy for a number of years. She's lived and worked in California, Ohio, and is back in her hometown of Washington, D.C., where she works with the Greater Greater Washington Advocacy Group. Hi, Alex. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. You were a Clevelander for a very short period of time. Now you're back in Washington, D.C.
Oh, I'm happy to be back home, though I do miss Northeast Ohio.
We have our good points up here, I would say. And this is a nice time of year. I do like spring and early summer in Cleveland. So, you know, you and I were introduced in kind of a roundabout way. I read an article on Ars Technica, and I really don't know what that website is particularly, but it was by Jonathan Gitland, and it was titled Bike Lanes Need Physical Protection from Car Traffic, Study Shows. So I contacted him. And he said, no, you need to talk to Alex Baca. So I said, okay, let's find her. So here we are. The study seems to say that just painting a bike lane on the road, it may be counterproductive. So tell me a bit about you and your work, and then we'll dive into this topic.
Sure. I right now work for a advocacy group and media organization called Greater Greater Washington. So we have a blog, but we also have an advocacy side. My title is Housing Program Organizer, so I actually work mostly on housing policy now, but I have a background in transportation and especially in bike advocacy. So in DC, I worked for the Washington Area Bicyclist Association, which is, you know, our regional bike advocacy group, and have sort of been in and out of that world throughout my career. When I was in Cleveland, I was running the bike share system there, which was a really cool job, and was also on the Bike Cleveland board. So I've sort of been in and out with a couple of things like that. But, you know, I've worked sort of in this nexus of housing, transportation, and land use for most of my career. I've also written about it. So I, you know, it was very flattering of Jonathan to point you to me. So thanks, Jonathan. I appreciate that. So that's kind of what I'm doing now. I've lived in DC, San Francisco, and Cleveland. I've bike commuted in all of those cities. But yeah, have actually, you know, been on the, you know, land use and policy side around housing more often now. So that's kind of what I'm into now, but I still bike to work, of course.
Right. So he seems to think that you really have a lot to say about bike lanes. Working with Bike Cleveland, I know Jacob Van Sickle pretty well. We're doing some really cool things here in Northeast Ohio. What's the current feeling in Washington about infrastructure, and how is that changing, if it is, or, you know, sort of coming back to some of the things we were talking about with the earlier transportation bill, which hasn't been happening in the last few years?
I think everyone here is really frustrated and really sad and really angry. I think there's a lot of negative sentiment around bike commuting in DC, which is terrible because more people are doing it. And that's a really, really good thing. And it's in line with some of the city's own stated like sustainability goals. Lots of cities will do this, right? That they'll put out a climate action plan, which actually I believe Cuyahoga County just released something of a climate action plan. DC has a sustainable DC plan. Those often call for shifts to modes other than driving, right? So whether it's biking, walking, or taking transit, because driving, single occupancy vehicles, is the largest emitter of greenhouse gases. So if you're looking at things from like a climate, air quality, public health perspective, like driving is really bad. So cities have a vested interest in making things better and healthier by, you know, supporting goals for other modes. Unfortunately, what tends to happen is that they don't really want to commit to doing the hard work of installing that or taking stuff away from drivers like space. So it tends to get really political really quickly, right? And so it turns it into less of a decision about what actually makes sense given what we know about like science and more about what people feel their city should be. So I, you know, started working in bike advocacy in DC in 2012. And prior to that, I had written for our Alt Weekly often about sort of, you know, transportation, public space, also about housing, and sort of how all that stuff works together. And in that time, you know, a lot more people have started riding bikes for transportation. There's more people who bike in DC now. It's awesome to see like bikes in front of like bars and restaurants and stores and stuff, and like know that I don't know the person who rode it there. Like I don't recognize the bike. Like that's awesome. Like I saw a group ride this weekend and I like didn't know anybody on it. And I was like, this is amazing. Like this is like, that's what everybody wants, right? Is that like, we really do want to grow this. And I think it's really important. So that's really great. But I said that I think everybody is frustrated because, you know, the city in DC certainly is, I don't think, meaningfully committed at all levels to keeping people who aren't driving, so whether they're biking, walking, or taking transit, I don't think there's a meaningful commitment to keeping those people safe. And that includes me. And in DC, our commute, our sort of, you know, that mode share is really high, right? Like a, like almost half of people, if you combine transit, biking, and walking, which I tend to do, move around like that within the city. And so, you know, we have more people biking, and that's in line with our climate and sustainability goals. But the city's not really inducing that. And, you know, John's piece kind of speaks to, you know, people don't feel super safe with paint. But that's usually about the level of, you know, infrastructure that cities are comfortable with installing because it's not super politically difficult. But even one painted bike lane can be very politically difficult.
Really? Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Alex Baca. She is with Greater Greater Washington, an advocacy organization. So if there is no solid plan for transportation and infrastructure, how are we going to ever get protected bike lanes built? I mean, it's obvious that this president said before, while he was campaigning, he was going to put this big infrastructure bill into place. I don't even think a bill has come before Congress yet.
The interplay between national and local policy for transportation funding is pretty interesting. Our federal spending for transportation infrastructure, 80% of it goes to roads and 20% of it goes to everything else. That's crazy. But that's been true not just under our current president. That's been true for decades.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think, you know, that is a lot of people are responsible for that. So, you know, we like driving in the U.S. We're very comfortable with that. There's a lot of reasons why we drive. Our laws in many ways underpin having things being farther apart from each other. You know, like I said, I work on housing and land use, and that has a lot to do with zoning codes, which dictate where things can go. And in America, the way our zoning codes have developed have largely said that things are far apart from each other. You kind of need to drive to get there. So we're up against a lot of regulatory infrastructure that supports a lifestyle that's kind of the opposite of biking to get around, which requires a sort of dense, compact neighborhoods where your job is near where your house is, which is near where you shop, which is near your kid's school, which is something that I think we all sort of idealize. But then when you take the harder steps to actually make that happen, people feel like that's an infringement. So there's that sort of cultural factor. In terms of the funding for this stuff and what do you need to do, I mean, it is political, as much as I hate to admit it. This should be common sense, right? Like, we're headed toward a climate crisis, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to have people drive all the time. And one of the ways to make people feel comfortable is to build protected bike infrastructure. But if you have people who are representing you, but they're not interested in installing this stuff because they perceive their constituents to be people who like to drive and park in front of where they go, they're not going to commit to a protected bike lane. So it is very political. So I think you can make demands of your elected leaders. We're doing more of that in DC, right? Where we're saying more aggressively because we've had some really significant deaths due to traffic crashes in DC. You know, we're saying we need to ask for more. We need to be really present. We need to email our elected officials every week. We need to show up. We need to submit testimony. We need to really be engaged in that political process. And when they're up for election, we need to say, if you don't represent our interests, we're going to vote you out. And interest groups have been doing that forever. But bike advocacy has tended towards, I think, the normal sort of nonprofit, sort of depoliticized advocacy. And I totally understand that. I worked in it for several years and I have a lot of respect for it. But it doesn't quite match up to the reality of how political transportation planning actually is.
Along those same lines, there was a rally for streets that don't kill people in DC last month. You know, and we report, unfortunately, almost weekly on cyclists who have been hit, pedestrians too, but mainly cyclists because that's what the show is, who have been hit, especially by hit and run drivers, which never makes any sense to me how you could hit someone and drive your car away. But what was the rally for streets that don't kill people, and how did that accomplish anything?
So, yeah, I mean, the rally came out of, this is actually, I think, the second rally for streets that don't kill people. The Washington Area Bicyclist Association has used that name for rallies before. In this case, this turned out to be a lot larger because last month, somebody who was a dear friend of many of us, whose name was Dave Salovech, was killed in a very brutal crash. And 2 days later, a pedestrian was killed east of the Anacostia River in a, you know, a part of a neighborhood that was acknowledged as just really unsafe, where there had been a lot of speeding, where people had been hit before. So, you know, a lot of that turnout was driven because people knew Dave, right? And so people were really angry. You know, he was a really vocal proponent of safe streets and had, you know, continually made the case that the city wasn't doing enough to protect people who bike and walk and take transit. So, you know, there was certainly a lot of anger and frustration and energy, and rallies are a great outlet. They also are highly visible. Politicians tend to respond to high visibility pressure like that. So rallies can be beneficial in that sense. You know, occupying space in front of the Wilson Building, which is our city hall, is something that tends to command attention in ways because it's kind of a nuisance and it's a little bit confrontational. And I think that's important to make sure that your elected officials are being held accountable. But it was also, you know, quiet and respectful. People laid down in the street in the middle of the center running bike lane in DC. I think for a lot of people, it was an opportunity to sort of like grieve and also work out the fear that like they might be killed doing something that is frankly a net benefit for their city.
Wow. So do you think these kinds of rallies actually make a difference? Were there legislators who saw it and said, are there any bills coming into your city council that are looking at this?
Yes. And that stuff had been, this kind of sped up the timeline for one piece of legislation, which was a Vision Zero omnibus bill. So one of our council members introduced that on a sort of more accelerated timeline. There was also emergency legislation to make fixes to the road where Dave was killed, which has been studied and is in this really intense planning process. So there's emergency legislation to mandate that that timeline be moved up. This is a longer term bill, but something that kind of mandates a complete street style installation of making sure that bike lanes are installed when streets are resurfaced. So that has some kinks to be worked out in the legislative process, but that's ongoing. So yeah, the rally alone didn't do that, right? Like we had over 100 people write customized letters just as like a volunteer kind of like, I asked my friends to do it and they asked their friends to do it, you know, send like really personal letters to their council members, to our at-large council members, to the mayor's office. That primed our legislators to basically say like, okay, like we have support to do this. We have the constituent support to do this. You know, these two really significant deaths, leveled up, but really illuminated that like the worst thing that could possibly happen. So a lot of the things that interest groups like mine and the Washington Area Bicyclist Association have been saying for years, like were proven to be true, right? Which is that like someone was going to lose their life. And many people, you know, under our current mayor, 129 people have died in traffic fatalities. So it's not just that it was Dave's death, but it was a person who was able to galvanize, you know, this community, as it were. And I think that that was finally like, you had a lot of our council people being like, ooh, like, yeah, okay, so this hit much closer to home for a lot of other people, which is unfair, right? Like, other lives lost, like, should have demanded this level of action, to be clear. But this was certainly a rallying point in a way that we haven't had before. And so I think it's, you know, it's collective action, right? Like, just a rally doesn't solve this. Like, just emails doesn't solve this. And like, we are lucky to have like pretty good council people working on some of our committees and some of this legislation, but it did move things with more urgency and you kind of need that combination of action. And like, you can't let up. I tell people to email every week, email every day, call their council member's office. Like, you have to be really, really vigilant. In some ways, that feels really unfair, but it's what you have to do.
Yeah, it seems to me when we have the National Bike Summit and suddenly 500 people are marching on Capitol Hill asking their legislators to all do the same thing, you know, usually there's an ask, that suddenly somebody wakes up. The question is, will they stay awake and will they actually make a change? So what do you think might change if fewer people drove, more people biked, walked, or used public transit? And is that something you see happening in the future?
I think, you know, the future's here, right? Like DC's mode share, right? The percentage of people that take different modes of transportation has started to shift really substantially. Like we have neighborhoods where we have like, I want to say like 12% of people bike commuting to work. Like that's really high for like a citywide average that's kind of, I think like 2%, right? Like you're seeing it, especially in neighborhoods that are dense, compact, and walkable, where things are close to other things, where it's harder to park your car, where there's more public transit, right? Like biking is like the most effective way to get around, so people do it. So in many ways, like that future is already here. Our cities are categorically refusing to acknowledge that. I think because like elected officials tend to drive, right? Like there's only one of our city council people who, as far as I know, sometimes bikes and sometimes takes the bus to work. The rest of them drive. So, you know, they have windshield perspective and their thoughts are very much, you know, that my constituents, like this is what they want. They want to drive and park. And you really have to break that mindset and say that this is going to have to change. I mean, this is not like 100% ban cars, war on cars overnight, but like there's limited space on streets. And at some point, some of that has to be redistributed to make them fair and safer. So I would really like to see cities acknowledge that people already want to do that, right? Cleveland has a pretty dedicated core of like, a, you know, not just like recreational cyclists, but people who bike to work. I biked to work in Cleveland and I didn't feel like the city was doing anything to keep me safe and that nobody there would really care if I died. And that sucks. Politicians, they're not going to be made aware of this stuff unless constituents make them feel it. And that's really hard because it's really easy to brush off like what you perceive to be a minority. So that's really hard. But, you know, in my ideal future, right, like nobody dies, right? Like we actually have Vision Zero and nobody dies in a traffic fatality. I think that's a really great place to start. But for cities and like that have like really challenging air quality issues, Northeast Ohio is a region with really challenging air quality issues. That's something that like I would love to see fewer kids with asthma because people are driving less because they can bike to where they need to get to go or they can walk to where they need to go. I would like people to be safe and I would like people to enjoy moving around as much as I do, right? Like I bike and walk. I still have a car. I drive very infrequently. I don't do it to get around every day. I didn't do it in Cleveland either. And I certainly didn't do it in San Francisco. And I think my life was a lot better for it. And so I would like other people to get the benefits of that.
It's interesting you said that because you'd have to live in a very special place in Cleveland not to use your car. You have to live fairly close to where you work because even our public transit system is not excellent here. It is in DC.
That's true. But also, you know, I lived in Ohio City and worked in St. Clair Superior. So it's not perfect. And you're not going to replace all of these trips, but there's a lot of trips that you can change the way that you move around. It may mean changing habits, right? It may mean that you don't buy groceries for the week. You buy groceries for a few days. And I know that there is limitations, but there are definitely ways to make that shift. And I think that like fundamentally people aren't going to do that. And we don't necessarily need to ask that of individuals when we can change the way that that works at a structural level. I was involved with public transit advocacy in Cleveland as well. And I understand the challenges there very much, but a lot of my neighbors in Ohio City would drive to the bar on West 25th, which I kind of find unconscionable.
Well, on that note, I'm going to let you go. Interesting conversation. We've been speaking with Alex Backus. She is with GGC Washington, Greater Greater Washington. It's an advocacy organization. You can find out more at ggwash.org, I think.
Yep, that's correct. Thank you.
Yeah. And I appreciate your perspective. Certainly, we hope that more people will consider using their bicycles and their feet instead of jumping in their car for everything. We've been talking about this for years, but I think there's been an acceleration of both interest and maybe concern that will start to change the tide, that quote unquote tipping point.
Yeah, I hope so. This was a really great conversation. Thanks so much for having me, Diane.
We will probably talk again. Thanks, Alex. Yeah. Have a great day.
Okay. All righty.
Bye-bye. Alex Backa joined me from her office at Greater Greater Washington in the nation's capital. Let's hope she's correct, that the future is here, that we'll begin to see more positive and sustained action to make streets safer and get more infrastructure projects funded. It would also be nice to see laws passed that protect vulnerable users as well as prosecute offenders. If you're interested, you can find out more at ggwash.org. So let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll speak with Sacramento frame builder Steve Rex. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM. WJCU University Heights.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Even after all these years, I still love speaking with and learning from frame builders. This week, Steve Rex, who has been building frames since the late 80s, yep, way back then, gives us his perspective on the craft. Hi, Steve. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
My pleasure. Thank you for getting in touch.
Well, you know, I don't even know where to begin. You make beautiful machines, first of all. I spent a lot of time on your site looking at pictures today.
Thank you.
You have lots of cool ideas. You're getting lots of accolades. Can you tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, and then how you got into cycling?
Well, I grew up in Southern California, the L.A. area, a little town called El Segundo, which is right next to the L.A. airport. And I rode bikes. Rode Schwinn Stingrays and BMX bikes, and also, you know, had a cheap Italian bike boom 10 speed that I rode to the beach and whatnot. And during college, I started racing bikes, and that kind of launched my career, really.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to Sacramento State University here in Sacramento. That's how I landed here. I moved up here in 1980 to go to college.
And you never left.
Yeah.
That's what I did. I came to Cleveland to go to college and never left.
Long time ago. That's what happens to some of us.
Yeah, I like it here. And I like Sacramento, by the way. We've been there a couple times for NABS. We think it's a really cool town.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I like Sacramento a lot. This really is my home. You know, I've lived in LA area for 18 years and here for 40 years. So.
Yeah, just do the math. It's really simple. So before we talk about your frames and bikes, I want to get into a little bit of your history because you've done some randonneuring. This is a PBP year. You've done that event several times. Plan on doing that again?
No, probably. Well, there's no plans to, unless there's some, unless I find the fountain of youth and turn back the clock on lots of my injuries, it probably won't happen again. I've done it three times. That's, you know, a good run.
It is a good run.
Next year, my wife and I plan on going to that part of France and riding the course, the Paris course in about 2 weeks, which will be a better pace than 3 days.
Yeah, 90 hours, right? You think? Yeah, really.
Yeah.
So you also hold some sort of a tandem course record. What tandem course?
It's the Furnace Creek 508.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's you've heard of that one, right?
I have.
It's a qualifying race it's a race by itself, a 508-mile race, and it's one of the qualifiers for RAM. We did that in 2001, I think.
And that was your wife? Was your stoker?
No. Actually, my brother-in-law was the stoker.
Hmm.
He's one of the reasons I got into long-distance cycling. He had done Paris in 1995, and we did it in 99, 03, and 07. And after the 1999 event, we had become really close friends with Dan Chidone, who is he was part of the Davis Bike Club, and he was the regional Brevet. Well, actually, he was not the regional Brevet coordinator, but he was heavily involved. And we were having dinner after PVP, and he talked about doing the Silk Climb event. And Peggy said, well, you're about my size. You should just get on the back of our tandem and do it with Steve. So we ended up doing that race. It was up Mount Diablo, which is here in Northern California, East Bay. And we won the Silk Climb. And I think that's what got Dan's wheels turning and he put together this Davis Bike Club team to attack the course record of the Furnace Creek 508. So there were four bikes, eight riders, and six of those riders had done Paris-Brest-Paris in 99.
Wow.
So it was a really, really cool event. Great fun.
Interesting story. Interesting. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Steve Rex. He's a frame builder out in Sacramento who's done some pretty cool things, evidently. We actually have a friend who's going to be doing his ninth consecutive PBP this year.
Nice.
Yeah.
What's that person's name?
Paul Baccio.
Okay.
Yeah, he also has crewed Ram a few times. You know, he does all kinds of long-distance stuff. He's a really cool guy. Really cool guy.
Great.
So let's talk about your work. We should do that.
Mm-hmm.
Were you in retail at some point? Did I read that correctly, that you had a store?
Yeah, yes. I started building frames in 1987, and I built them in my garage and sold them out of a shop that I worked at. And that shop closed in 1990, and I started looking for a space. I thought this is the time for me to just go out on my own. And I had been a service manager there, so I thought I would do a retail storefront where I took in repairs, did tune-up, change flats and whatnot, and also made frames. Because in 1990, custom-made bikes weren't really a thing yet.
Right.
It's not. It wasn't the phenomenon that it is now. So I opened a storefront, and I was a shopkeeper until last year. After a little while, I got an employee mechanic and just started making frames full time. That was like the year, probably 1992 or three. And then last year I gave the repair business to my longtime mechanic, and he just took over the shop space, and I built a workshop in my backyard. So I just make frames in my backyard, and it was a lifestyle choice. Didn't want to be a shopkeeper anymore.
Yeah, believe me. I've been there, done that. Yes, I know. It's people don't understand how much work it is to show up and open that door every single day, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And hope somebody falls through it. Who were your influences? Who influenced you in the way you build bikes? And I do want to talk about how you build your bikes, because they are interesting, and they are, some of them are very unusual.
Well, thanks. Certainly, Albert Eisentrout, I mean, he is the sort of the father of modern American frame building, craft frame building, certainly. He influenced lots of people in the Bay Area in the 70s. And some of those people that I've been influenced by are Tom Ritchie and Steve Potts. And locally, there was a fellow named Michael Johnson, who made some very nice bikes, and also a guy almost no one has ever heard of named John Padgett, who made just beautiful, beautiful Philip Braze bikes. And the French builders that did the bilaminate style, which is kind of a half lug, half Philip Braze joint,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is a style that I like a lot.
When I look at your menu, and it's pretty broad, you offer a lot of frame ideas, but what would you say is the core basis for your frames, the core tenet? If somebody were to say, well, Steve Rex is fill in the blank kind of frame builder.
I am a frame builder that puts fit and performance first. And style second, I guess. I've always really, really focused on the fit aspect of the bike and design. For years and years, people have come to me and done a fitting in my shop. Probably 90% of my customers have had fittings done by me. So that's kind of been the basis for everything that I've done. As far as the style of the type of bike that I've done most is road bikes, sport riding, road bikes, touring bikes, that sort of thing. And I think that's a result of the area that I live in. There's just a ton of road riding here, and right in Sacramento, not so much mountain biking and dirt. Although these days I'm making mostly kind of gravel-ish, gravel-ish, road-ish bikes.
Hybrids.
Road bikes. Yeah, hybrids.
Right. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Steve Rex. We're going to take a real quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk to him a little bit about his fitting techniques, since that's, you know, one of my favorite topics. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with frame builder Steve Rex. He's out in the Sacramento area. And when we ended, we were talking about hybridish gravel road, the kinds of bikes that he builds. So tell me a little bit about your fitting techniques, because I've been doing fittings for decades.
It's, oh, great.
It's what became the specialty of our shop, too, that even if we didn't build our own frames, that we did do all of the fitting and designing of the frames so people like Seven and Waterford could build them. So tell me what your fitting philosophy is, and then how you go about it a little bit.
Well, I have always used a sizing cycle. I made one for myself 30 years ago. So I believe that the dynamic fitting process is the best way to go about things. And it takes someone that is sympathetic, has experience, and knows some biomechanics to do it right. Thankfully, the days of the fit kit are gone, and people do practical dynamic fittings more. But it seems like everyone's a fitter, just like everyone's a frame builder these days.
Yeah, good point. It's true. You know, it's like, oh, well, here's another analogy that you may or may not appreciate. Being a longtime yoga teacher, all of a sudden, everybody's a yoga teacher. You know, they're just churning out students who become teachers really, really quickly. And you wonder where they're getting experience. But if you look at your experience, 30 years, my experience, 30, 40, whatever it is, you know, that brings a lot to the table. So have you found that people who are getting frames from you, Has your idea of fitting and their fitting needed to change because of their getting, is your client older, I guess, is what I'm asking?
Recently, my clientele has been a little bit older. Certainly older than the 90s when I was making lots of race bikes. But I still get all kinds of customers. As I said, one needs to be sympathetic and understand what's going on, and be a good listener and hear what the people are experiencing to make the necessary changes. And I think, you know, that's always been the case. So in that regard, I don't think things are changing. There are more people riding later in life now than there were 20, 30 years ago. That's for certain.
So people are aging up.
Yes.
So when do your customers come back to you? Let's say somebody you sold a bike to 25 or 30 years ago. Are they coming back to you for a new bike, or are you upgrading an existing bike? How much of that are you doing?
God bless them. I get a lot of return customers. That it's a wonderful thing. The last two bikes that I delivered were return customers. One, the very last one, I made a bike for a fellow 20 years ago, and he was a racer, and it was an S&S bike that was shaped like a race bike. And last year, he took that bike on a trip, and airlines lost it.
No.
And he thought, oh my God, I've got to call Steve and get another bike. And about a week before he called me, about a week later, the bike showed up. But he said, you know what? I'm just going to order another one.
Wow. The fact that it showed up is a miracle.
Yeah, right. Right.
That's cool.
Yeah. And the other one was, say, the third bike that I've made for this particular customer.
You know, it's interesting that people come back and buy more than one bike. You wonder, well, what are they doing with them? But they, you know, they do different things with them. So I totally get it. I want to talk a little bit about forks. You build your own, I know that. But you also offer a lot of other forks. Do you need to change your idea of design to accommodate a fork that you don't make? Or are you looking at forks that will work with your designs? Does that make sense, what I asked?
Yes. Okay. Yes. I always try to use a fork that is going to be the closest fork, pre-made fork for the design. So usually the limitation is the offset, the amount of rake that a fork has, because you can't, just make a carbon fork that has a 50 millimeter rake into one that has a 60 millimeter rake. So you go with the person wants a carbon fork, or that's what's best for this kind of bike, and you work with that. So what I typically do is pick a front center measurement that I need, and then use the rake head angle stem combination to get the fit and handling characteristics that I want. So I work back from a given front center.
Okay, that makes sense. What's going on with these through axles? And I'll ask about road discs, because everybody knows that I have opinions about road discs, and they've sort of fluctuated over the last couple of years, but I still say road discs are, for the most part, unnecessary. I don't know. That's just me being old fashioned, but what's going on with you and road discs and through axles and all this new stuff, oversized bottom brackets and head tubes?
Right, right. Well, through axles, I do them. And one does them because of disc brakes. And, there are advantages of disc brake, and there are disadvantages. I'm convinced that the driver of the disc brake market has been carbon wheels. You know, manufacturers want to make and sell carbon wheels. They don't work well with side pull brakes, so let's do disc brakes.
Right.
And that's, that's the primary reason to use in my opinion, to use a road bike with disc brakes, unless you have really inclement weather all the time, and then it's probably the best way to go. But I'm not convinced that it's the way to go for everyone. Certainly, there's no way to make the bike as light with disc brakes and wheels. It just doesn't happen.
Right.
I think side poles and aluminum rims work really, really well.
You won't get an argument from me on that.
And they have for a long, long time. But I'm not going to talk someone out of disc brakes either, because there is a place for them, and there are some advantages. The light touch of hydraulic discs is pretty cool. You know, you don't have to have a lot of lever pressure to get a lot of stopping force. And for some people, that's a real advantage. People with some hand malady or hand weakness, that can be a real plus.
Yeah, that's true. That now there's a piece of it that I didn't think about. People who actually may have some arthritis or other stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
How are your clients finding you, your new clients?
Well, we're going to see how that plays out in the next year. Now that I don't have a storefront, people still find me through the web. I have done a ton of frame repairs lately for people who, found me on the web somehow, or Instagram. The only thing that's active for me as far as advertising is Instagram. Every week or so, I'll put up some pictures. And the website is super basic. It's got information.
It's actually got a lot of information if you spend some time on it. But you're right. It is basic. And I kind of like that. It's just like to the point. This is it.
Yep.
Pay attention. Who's painting your bikes?
I'm sorry?
Who's painting your bikes?
Mostly Ollie at Dark Matter in Colorado. He's very good. But I just said that on the air.
Is there a problem with that?
I don't want him. No. I'm just teasing. I don't want him to get too busy because it'll take too long.
Exactly. It'll turn his queue into like this forever. Well, but because you said it, maybe he'll put your frames in the front of it, which brings me to my next question. How long is your queue these days?
It's not very long right now. I don't have that many orders. So 3 months. 3-4 months.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Which is historically low for me. That's quick turnaround by the last 10 years standards.
Yeah.
So if anyone out there needs a bike, give me a call.
Because it's a short queue and it's a short season. At least it is back here. Boy, the season's been weird here. We are just now getting on our bikes. It has been so cold. So what do you do when you aren't building bikes? I know you have a grandchild.
I have two grandchildren.
Oh.
And I see them a lot. That was part of the reason that I built this home workshop, just so that I would have more flexibility and more time to spend with them, which has been great. And my wife and I dance. We go out to a lot of live music, going out tonight. It's
ballroom dancing, swing. What do you do?
Swing dancing.
Yep. West Coast swing.
Not West Coast.
Oh,
the East Coast family, like it's Lindy Hop.
Yeah, right. We
Balboa.
Took dance for a while, Brian and I.
Yeah.
Well, nice. How cool are you? See, grown men dance. I love it. I love it.
Oh, heck yeah. It is so fun. We have seen more live music in the last 4 or 5 years than I had my entire life.
Nice.
Put together. It's been great. In fact, next, we went to a music festival weekend before last up in Eureka, California. And we're going to another one next weekend down in Tehachapi, California.
Wow. And you just dance. They actually have these festivals and you can dance.
Yes, there are. There's dance floors. Yep. It's, you know, they're primarily music festivals. The one in Eureka was kind of all over the map style-wise. There was some jazz and rockabilly and blues, lots of blues, and Western swing. And this one down in Tehachapi is a Western swing event.
Fun. So, fun.
Yeah, it's great.
Well, this has been a wonderful conversation. I have three questions I always ask my fun guests. What's your favorite food?
Street tacos.
Wow, what does that mean? Sweet tacos?
like taco truck, Mexican style.
Street tacos. Okay, I heard it as sweet, and I'm like, what's sweet about street tacos? I get it. Cool.
No, yeah, the kind of tacos you buy on the street.
Yeah, got it. Exactly. Yeah. Well, I guess I know what music you like because you just told us, unless you have more options
well,
there.
Well, I have all kinds of musical interests, but lately I've been listening to a lot of Western swing and old country and honky-tonk music.
Nice. You have music in your shop, I take it.
Oh, yes.
Do you have any pets?
We have a 12-year-old long-haired cat named Lucy.
Lucy.
My number one grandson calls Lulu. She's Lulu.
Well, that's cute. Well, Steve, this has just been wonderful. Thank you so much for talking with me. We've been speaking with Steve Rex from Rex Cycles in Sacramento, California. It's rexcycles.com if you are interested. And the queue isn't too long. I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful season. And by the way, congratulations on your NABs again this year. You are a multiple NABs winner.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for talking with me.
All right, Diane. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. If you want to get in the queue or just find out more about Steve Rex and his work, you can log on to rexcycles.com. So dancing and tacos and steel frames, there's nothing not to like there. That's our show for this week. My thanks to Steve and to Alex Baca from Greater Washington, as well as Kate Harley from yourmoveohio.org. Remember that you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can send us a tweet at OutspokenCyclist without an E, or leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. Please consider leaving a review, hopefully a good one, on your podcast app, or just rate us with a bright and shiny group of stars. The more reviews we get, the higher we go in the rankings, and the more listeners we'll have. That's how it works. We'll be back next week with a brand new show, and until then, I hope you have a great week. Stay safe out there, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.